We are studying in Luke chapter 9, and we have been in the paragraph that is marked out by verses 28 to 36. Now, just in way of a recap in terms of the whole chapter, in our studies of Luke 9, we have seen that they revolve around the fact that the chapter begins with Jesus sending out the 12 to do what they have up to this point only watched him do. Luke chapter 10, verse 1, after chapter 9, the Lord anoints 70 others and sends them out to do what up till then they'd only watched him do. Now that means then that chapter 9, verse 1, up through chapter 9, verse whatever the last verse is, 62, is apparently a text that has to do with preparing his men to do what they have been commissioned to do and dealing with some of the issues that come up when they try to do that. And I really believe that because Luke 10 starts out the same way, that that makes the last words of Luke chapter 9 pretty serious. It says that Jesus said in verse 62 of chapter 9, "No one, after putting his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God." Basically, what that is saying is that we better not back up, that going forward as his disciples is our only course. So we've been seeing in our current focus of study in the paragraph that is found in verses 28 through 36, that in the middle of this chapter, he is giving at least three of his disciples an opportunity to see the very kingdom that they have put their hands to the plow in regard to. And Luke is presenting Jesus in this paragraph, as we've seen in our consideration of the conversation that he had with Moses and Elijah, that Jesus is, in view of a coming exodus that he is going to fulfill in Jerusalem, the Passover Shekinah. And what I mean by that is he's the combination of the hyphenated provision of God. He is the Passover lamb of the coming Exodus, and he is the same Shekinah that is being seen here in this paragraph, the brilliant light as he's transformed, that originally shone between Israel and the armies of Pharaoh on that dark night as they fled from Egypt and they were protected by the column of fire that was the Shekinah glory of God. And then when the day dawned, they discovered that the fire had turned into a pillar of cloud so that they could see him. And as he moved ahead of them, they followed. So he was their guide and provider. And it's indicative, I believe, of that whole scenario of the Exodus, Passover, Shekinah, protector, provider thesis in light of the end of the chapter, that nobody putting his hand to the plow should take it off. He's not worthy of the kingdom if he does. I think that that also harkens back to that thesis of the Exodus that Jesus is going to provide. Because we have multiple texts in the scriptures of Israelites, a whole generation actually of Israelites, who perished in the wilderness because they kept, in effect, taking their hands off the plow. Let me just point you to a few statements. Let's look at Exodus 16. In Exodus 16, it says that they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness, and the sons of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the Lord's hands in the land of Egypt, wherein we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Now this is 2 months after they've been phenomenally delivered by massive demonstrations of the Shekinah of God. They're already bellyaching about how good they had it in Egypt. But you'd have never known that listening to them before the fact, because it was the cry of their bondage that reached the ears of the Lord of hosts in heaven that caused him to bring them out. So, you know, they didn't waste any time looking back, taking their hands off the plow. There are actually three other places that have to do with him whining about how bad they've got it out here in the wilderness. One of them had to do with the provision of the manna. And they said, "We're sick and tired of eating this manna," and complaining and complaining and complaining. In fact, Psalm 106:14 says that they lusted powerfully in the wilderness, and the focus was on how they were bellyaching. And the whole issue there is taking their hands off the plow, looking back, marginalizing how bad they had it, and fantasizing about how good they had it before all of these difficult things in the wilderness began. So when Luke introduces Jesus in this passage in Luke 9 as the one who's about to fulfill another exodus in the city that is known by God at this point in history as Egypt, we got that from Revelation 11, that there is going to be a new deliverance based on a different foundation. But at the end of the chapter, Jesus point blankly says, once you've entered into this deliverance thing, put your hand on the plow, don't look back. So given the probability that people will look back, the text before us this morning in Luke 9, particularly verse 33, it came about as these were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it's good for us to be here, and let us make three tabernacles, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." Big hyphen, not realizing what he was saying. I've called this the verse that contains Luke's record of Peter's nonsense. Luke is, I believe, in this verse continuing what I proposed last week. That is, he's showing us how profound is God's commitment to bring us to the kingdom by showing us what he must and does address in the process, because we've already seen that one of the biggest problems that God has to address is the male issue, the men who are male, responsible responders, who live in contradiction to the essence of the universe. And God has to address that. How does he get them to see the truth? And then, not only that, but the presence of the brilliant light is not an automatic solution in verse 32, where they see his glory and the two men who were standing with him, because we know that Satan can convert himself into the appearance of an angel of light, and so there are some other things that have to be dealt with, not just being impressed by the brilliance of the light. And then finally, the problem of the men being asleep in verse 32, having been overcome, makes them victims. That's a passive concept. They couldn't have stayed awake if they were determined to. I'm not sure they were determined to, but even if they had been, they were overcome. I don't know if Luke knew it. I'm pretty sure he did, because he was a man of his age. But in the Roman mythology, there was a god of sleep. And he was so powerful that he could even put other gods to sleep. So in the final analysis, the god of sleep was the most powerful god there was, because he could put you out where you couldn't do anything. And I'm not at all sure that Luke didn't have a little bit of that in his mind when he said they were overcome with sleep, because he actually uses terminology in there that names the god of sleep in the word sleep. But in any case, he's showing us that men who ought to be wide awake are asleep. And this just compounds the problems. If you can't stay awake, if you can't tell what's an angel of light and what's a fake promoter of light, if you can't be a man who responds to the universe as God made it rather than as a rebel, then obviously God's got a real job on his hands if he's ever going to bring any human beings to the kingdom. But he is, and that's the whole point. Now, I really believe that in verse 33, we have a continuation on Luke's part of a record of words that show something about human beings that God has to overcome and is going to. So I want to do, as we did last week, in verse 32 when we started at the back and backed up. I mean, at the bottom of the verse. I want to do that again because I've said that Peter's words were nonsense, and I derived that conclusion from the end of verse 33, that he didn't realize what he was saying. And I want to start there because I think that there is an enormous problem when we don't understand what we're saying. I think that Luke is deliberately pointing out how easy we use words with no understanding. It's not that we don't think we understand them, because we do think that. But our expression of the words often is a revelation of just how ignorant we are. It's kind of like, I don't know if it's a proverb or something that Benjamin Franklin said, but somebody said that it's better for you to keep your mouth shut and be thought a fool than to open and prove it. Well, Peter never learned that. He was always the one who was going to blurt something out. And Luke's comment at the end of his blurting out this thing about building three tabernacles, Luke's comment was he didn't realize what he was saying. So I believe that Luke is deliberately trying to tell Theophilus and us as we read it that Peter didn't have a clue as to what he was doing with his words. And I really believe that Luke clearly meant that Peter's ignorance was not of his words, or even what he meant by them. I think he really did mean, let's build three tabernacles, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah. It's great for us to be here, Master. I think he knew what he meant, and I think he used words that expressed what he meant, but they clearly were not a legitimate expression of the reality that those words bounced off of once he uttered them. There was something completely wrong with what he said. And he was one of the leading of the 12. So I believe that what Luke is doing at the end of verse 33, not realizing what he was saying, was he's telling us about Peter's spontaneous, off-the-wall, motor mouth, as a record of a man who actually revealed his heart while being clueless about the condition of his heart. He really thought it'd be a great idea. He was ecstatic about his privilege. It's good to be here. But he didn't have a clue. Now, in light of that, what I'm going to argue this morning is that Peter was recorded by Luke as expressing himself without thought. And when that happens, generally you get a real picture. You can't always tell what you're hearing when a person has time to think and be thoughtful about what he says. But the spontaneous, that'll typically reveal some things because Jesus said so. And in the Sermon on the Mount back there in chapter 6 that I referred to in the call to worship this morning, Jesus said in verse 45, of the abundance of the heart, a man's mouth speaks. Now, if you look at that passage in verse 45 of chapter 6 and just back up about or four verses, you'll discover that Jesus said that on the heels of castigating the hypercritics who were going around criticizing everybody else and being so hypocritical because the problems that they had in their own lives were far greater than anything that they were finding in their fellow man's life. And Jesus said, how is this? The hypocrisy that is so vast that you go looking for a little speck in somebody else's eye, and you can't even see the beam in your own. That was when he said, out of the abundance of the heart, a man's mouth speaks. And what he's saying is, you're going to see this blind hypocrisy when a man is caught by what he says. And then, verse 45 of chapter 6 is the immediate predecessor to the statement that Jesus made in verse 47 when he said this, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do the things which I say? Is there anything more hypocritical than that? To call Jesus Lord and just be flatly outright disobedient. So when Luke records that Jesus said that it is a truism that if you catch a man expressing himself without thought, typically what you're seeing there is the condition of the heart, the reality. And I believe that Luke's point in this particular part of his record when he said that Peter didn't realize what he was saying. I think part of the point is to show us the condition of a man's heart that God has to deal with if, in fact, he has any real intention of bringing a kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy to pass with heirs out of the human race. He's got to do something about this ability to just spew all this stuff out that is completely contrary to the truth and think that it's something that you ought to be excited about. So, working backwards in the verse from that statement, not realizing what he's saying, I believe that we have a statement by Luke that Peter was exposing his heart without even knowing it. But if we back up just a little bit, what was it that he didn't realize that he was saying? What did he say? Well, he said, let's make three tabernacles. One for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. I read that and I thought, now what in the world did he have in mind? What is this building tabernacle stuff about? So I did what I always do. I started looking at the way that the terms are used and trying to fit them into the context of Peter's thought here and the fact that he didn't realize what he was saying. And so I'm going to take you through a little bit of the process that I went through, because I believe that the statement, let's build three tabernacles, had to have some meaning in Peter's heart, something that he believed ought to be done. In his exuberance, he revealed that he thought this would be a good idea. And therefore, in order to understand what he was expressing, we kind of have to understand what he would have understood from his use of the words. And that starts with the issue of what is a tabernacle. What is a tabernacle? Now, let me prejudice our consideration of that question by saying this, that Peter's thoughts were directed to building the tabernacles by reason of the conversation that he had just overheard. When Peter woke up, he was hearing Elijah and Moses, in verse 31, talking about a coming exodus that Jesus was going to fulfill at Jerusalem. The exodus terminology would have automatically directed Peter's mind in some way, because that's what he heard. And typically our reaction to what's going on is going to be primed by the pump of what we've heard. So, you understand that pump priming business? My aunt, my oldest aunt on my mom's side, lived in rural Oklahoma, and she had a little pump out on her back porch that had the pipe down into a cistern that caught the water that ran off the roof, and they would use that to wash their hair and stuff like that, because it's soft water. But you could never get that pump to pump any water if you just stood there and pumped the handle, because at the end of the rod there was some leather pieces that were designed to create the suction to pull the water up. Well, when the well wasn't being used, those pieces of leather would dry out and shrink, and therefore they would have no vacuum, and you couldn't get them to pump water. You'd just stand there and pump, and then nothing would happen. So whenever we wanted to pump water at the well, my aunt would give us a bucket of water and say, here, go prime the pump. That meant pour water down the pump. It will hit the leather, make it soft, it will expand, and then you can pump the handle and the water will come up. That's called priming the pump. I don't know if you knew that or not. Now you do. Okay, words are like that. They prime the pump in terms of our expectation. When Peter blurted out, let's build three tabernacles, he was doing it on the heels of something, and the something was the conversation about the coming exodus that Jesus was about to accomplish. Now keep this in mind. They didn't understand the coming exodus being his crucifixion. They'd already blocked that possibility out of their minds. That was not going to happen to Jesus. Not in their thinking. So, whatever this exodus meant had to have the Old Testament connotations in Peter's mind. And so, with the exodus terminology, tabernacle's automatic, because in Leviticus, if I've got this written down properly, chapter 23, verse 43, the children of Israel lived in tabernacles. It's translated booths by the Authorized Version, but that's just an English translation of the same word. They would call what we call the Feast of Tabernacles the Feast of Booths. And by booth, they meant a tabernacle, whatever that is. So, periodically, in the Leviticus thing, they were actually living in tabernacles after their departure from Egypt. And the reason was that they didn't have Motel 6s and Super 8s along the highway down to Sinai. So they couldn't all go and check into the motel at night whenever they had to stop. They had to have something to put their stuff in, and they would build a tabernacle, a booth. Now, that's the meaning of the term tabernacle, generally speaking. That's the one that Peter probably thought of immediately because of the Exodus terminology, because God said through Moses, when we came out of Egypt, when I led you out of Egypt, you dwelt in these tabernacles, these booths. But for our understanding of the implications of that, we really have to go to Hebrews chapter 9. So I'm going to ask you to do that. It's enlightening in terms of what a tabernacle is in verses 2 and 3. It says in verse 1 that even the first covenant had regulations of divine worship and the earthly sanctuary. For there was a tabernacle prepared, the outer one, tabernacle, in which were the lampstand and the table and the sacred bread. This is called the holy place. When you would go into what is typically referred to as the tabernacle, the first part of that was a room that had the candlestick and the table and the bread, showbread, and that was called the holy place, and that's the place where the priests went to do their ministry. But there was a veil in that area that marked or cut the inner sanctum in half so that there were two squares of room. The first one was called the holy place. Behind the veil, according to verse 3, there was a tabernacle which is called the Holy of Holies. And that's where the mercy seat and the cherubim were, and that's where God dwelt. That's where the Shekinah would go into the tabernacle at the end of the day after he had led them wherever, and they would set up the tent and he would dwell in that section, and as long as he was in there they didn't move, and the priests were absolutely forbidden to go in there except once a year. But somebody's going to say, well, I thought the whole thing was a tabernacle. Well, it was, but there was a tabernacle and a tabernacle and a tabernacle. Okay, now people that are listening to on this on CD can't see my hands. But there was a large tent, a tabernacle, that was twice as long as it was wide. And then there were two tabernacles divided by a veil in the tabernacle. One was the holy place and the second was the holy of holies. Now, the reason I point this out is that the word tabernacle is revealed here to mean more than just a tent or a booth or a place to be, because by dividing the larger tabernacle into two tabernacles, what we're actually being told is that a tabernacle is a place where certain items or people dwell. The outer tabernacle was where you put the bread and the table and the candlestick, and that's where they stayed, as long as the tent was pitched. And then behind the veil, there was this other tabernacle that had some furnishings, but that's where God stayed as long as they were there before they would move. So when we're pushing this idea of what Peter wanted to build, one of the clearest realities is that it wasn't so much a booth or a tent or a tabernacle as it was a place for somebody to be. And then if we go from Hebrews 9 over to Hebrews 11, the idea of a tabernacle is used there in verse 9, because it says in verse 8, by faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, verse 9 says, He lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise, because he was looking for the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Now, basically what that's telling us is that Abraham and his family were nomads, and they carried their dwellings along with them. They pitched a tent. That was called a tabernacle. But the point is, that's where they spent the night each night. And if they were going to be in the same area for a while, they would pitch it and they would live there until it was time to leave. But they didn't build a house because they were looking for a city. And it doesn't make any sense to build a house if you're looking for a more permanent dwelling called the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And verse 9 says that Abraham did this by faith, and the thing he did by faith was to dwell in a tabernacle. Because by refusing to build a permanent mansion building there to live in, as he grew wealthier and wealthier and could easily have done, he refused because his testimony was that he was looking for a city that had foundations, whose builder and maker was God, and I'm not going to spend all my time building this big fancy mansion just to leave it here when it comes time to go to the city. So he dwelt in a tent. The point that we're making here is that the idea of a tabernacle was the idea of a temporary dwelling. That was the point. Temporary. That, by the way, was the root of David's problem in 2 Samuel 7 when the Davidic covenant was established, because God had taken them into the land, and David and Saul and David and, you know, they had built themselves some pretty fancy houses. He was the king, after all. And one day he was looking out the window of his pretty fancy house and he saw the tent that God dwelt in. And the temporariness of that dwelling struck him hard on the heels of what God had done with Saul. And David knew that substantially, essentially, he wasn't any different from Saul. He was a man like Saul, and he had the same passions as Saul, and he realized that if he pulled the same kind of stunt that Saul pulled, God might do to him what he did to Saul, and that is pull the plug on him. You're not going to be king anymore. I'm going to replace you. And David saw that tent as a warning. God's dwelling with me here in this place might be very temporary. So he wanted to go and build God a permanent house. That way maybe God wouldn't move. That was the whole gist of David's fear. And into that fear, God made this promise. I didn't tell you to build me a house, but I'm going to tell you this. I'm going to build you a house. And you're going to be involved in what I'm doing from now till the end of eternity. And he put David's soul at rest about God's commitment to him by countering David's anticipation that the tent just meant a temporary thing. And I don't know if this is a good place to stick it in, but in John's Gospel, chapter 1, it says that the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. It's translated dwelt, but the word is skenao, and it means to pitch your tent, to dwell there. And Jesus didn't come to stay the first time. So he just pitched a tent, in effect, not literally. But the point that I'm making about all of this stuff with the tabernacle is that temporariness was a fundamental issue, and it was a faith issue. What Abraham did in Hebrews 11:9 was a faith issue, and it what he chose to do was deeply colored by what he believed. And my argument this morning is that what Peter said deeply colored or revealed what he really thought, and Luke says he didn't have a clue as to the reality of what he ought to be thinking. He's kind of like David, thinking that God would abandon him. I don't mean Peter thought Jesus would abandon him, but I mean he didn't have a clue. Temporariness. But when we continue our pursuit of meaning for tabernacle, we run into places like Genesis 33:17, where one of the patriarchs built tabernacles for his cattle. What does that mean? Well, it meant that he built them some shelters that they could get into if the weather went sour. In Nehemiah 8, we're told that they built these tabernacles out of brush and leaves and sticks and stuff like that. So if you think a tabernacle is a tent made out of skin or canvas or, you know, forget it. That's not the idea. The tabernacle is not identified by the materials that are used. It's identified by the function that it serves. Jonah, in chapter 4, verse 5, built himself a tabernacle, a booth, because he was sitting outside of the city of Nineveh, waiting on God to judge them like he had said that he was going to do, hoping that he would. But every day the sun is really hot, so he built him a little booth to keep out of the elements. And that's the basic issue when you stop and think about it. The tabernacle, it didn't matter what it was made out of. The point of it, this is where you're going to go inside. Why? Well, because of the elements. Rain, sunshine, heat, cold, whatever. You even did this for your animals. It's not a matter of what it was built by, but it was a matter of function. This is where the person placed, the person or thing or animal or whatever is supposed to get out of whatever makes life difficult or uncomfortable. So the tabernacle is identified by function, and its function was protection. Does that ring a bell? The Shekinah was a pillar of fire of protection. And the elements, I mean, Peter knew. When he said, let's build three tabernacles, he was talking about booths that would, if you went in them, the sun wouldn't shine on you and you'd be a little bit protected from the weather and all that kind of stuff. But there's a problem with our thinking about it that way when we read verse 33 of Luke 9, because the opening of the verse says, as it came about, as these were departing from him, Peter said, Master, it's good for us to be here. Let's make three tabernacles. Well, they're walking off. They're leaving. There are only a couple of things that you can decide about that. Either he thought that if he built the tabernacle, maybe they wouldn't leave. Or, perhaps better, he was moving in the same direction as the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles, where every year the people of Israel would move out of their comfortable homes and they'd move into these temporary booths that they would build as a celebration of the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. And it was supposed to be a reminder that they were temporary here. Of course, the impact of that meant that it was a memorial. Once every year at the Feast of Tabernacles, everybody would have to move out of their house and live in a booth. And it was supposed to remind them that this is where the promises of God came from and where they're headed. But, you know, as soon as the feast was over, they moved back into the comfort of their homes. I don't have to live in that. And, you know. The point that I want to make here is twofold. One was that the Feast of Booths was a memorializing event, and I think probably Peter had something like that in mind. Let's build some memorials here. The other thing that I want us to understand is that Peter's comments probably reflected more of the attitude of his culture than he even realized, because he was not thinking about the tabernacles as a real honest-to-goodness place to go live. It's a memorial. It's not something you need to get too terribly involved in. I mean, do it, but you can always move back into your waterbed or your, you know, sleep by number or whatever kind of bed you have when it's all over. And it'll be over in just a little bit, so God's really not asking a whole lot here. He's just temporary. I really believe that Peter's view, as an outgrowth of the fact that the Feast of Tabernacles was a memorializing practice and of the fact that people were treating it like it was something less than a memorial. It's something they did, but it didn't really carry any weight because they could always go back into their nice, comfortable place to live afterwards. It's kind of the difference between those pioneers in the early settling of the west of this country who would go out living in Conestoga wagons, and when they got to a place they considered to be where they really wanted to dwell, they would cut the prairie up in chunks of mud and grass and they'd stack them on top of each other and they'd move into what they called a soddy, where the snakes lived too and the spiders came to dwell, and they considered that home and they lived there. But there were always some from back east, when they would come out and see these people living that kind of way, they'd import their lumber and build their houses. I ain't living like that. Well, I think Peter had both of those things in mind. He had a memorial in mind to memorialize what's going on here, or had gone on here, but at the same time, Peter was not yet committed to paying the price. And I really believe that Peter's thinking had been subverted, and we have a picture of this, because by building a tabernacle, he wanted to memorialize an event that was, by its very definition and demonstration in verse 33, very temporary. In other words, don't hang on to this. Hang on to the significance of it, but don't hang on to the process of it. It's one thing to be captured by the significance of an event. It's another thing to idealize that event and start putting all your eggs in the basket of the idealized event. Peter wanted some way to memorialize this thing and make it stick, whatever. But I want you to notice that what happened in verse 33 was, in verse 32, when he became fully awake, saw Jesus' glory and the glory of the two men. And when they were leaving, he wanted to build three tabernacles for three people who had been made manifest by the light. The problem is here, he's doing the same thing the Jews did in Matthew 23, verses 16 and 17. In that text, Jesus castigates the religious leaders because they teach the people that if you swear by the temple, that's nothing, but if you swear by the gold of the temple, then you better keep your vow. And what they were doing was elevating the gold over the temple, and Jesus said, this is nuts. This is crazy. He said, you're taking the gold and exalting it above that which makes it valuable by sanctifying it. You ought to be sanctifying the temple and playing down the issue of the gold, but they turned it on its head. Well, my point is, Peter's whole perception is upside down. He doesn't know what he's saying. He wants to memorialize an event for three people because he's impressed by the light, and the thing that he doesn't understand is that Jesus made the light significant. The light didn't make Jesus significant. Jesus was who he was, whether the light was there or not. And it was just a way of showing his disciples that he was who he was by letting them see the Shekinah. But that he was the one that sanctified the light. The light didn't make him who he was. But Peter didn't think that way. Peter's thoughtless outburst revealed just how committed he was to transforming the truth into something he could be comfortable with. And then one more issue in verse 33 that I think we need to be aware of, because I'm arguing that Peter didn't have a clue. His whole world was upside down to the way it ought to have been as a disciple of Jesus. It says in verse 33, when it came about as these were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, Master. That word translated master is only used by Luke. You don't read this in any other record. And the essence of the word when it was coined was that a master was somebody who stood above others, literally stood upon them, stood over them. And the word master was used whenever you referred to somebody who was above you in status. Somebody who stood above you in terms of their importance and value and all that. So when we see Peter saying master, we think, well, you know, that's good. The problem is that every time Luke used this term, he used it in a context where the person using the word didn't believe it. The first time was back there in chapter 5. You remember in chapter 5, Jesus has asked Peter to let him use his boat because the people are getting too pushy. And he pushes him out off the shore. So, and this is after Peter had been fishing all night. And it says in verse 4 of chapter 5 that when he had finished his sermon or speaking, he said to Simon, put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch. And Simon answered and said, Master. But notice what else he said. We've worked hard all night and caught nothing. So what does that mean? Master. Do you know who the fishermen are here? Is that the way you use the word master? Peter was obviously reluctant to let his nets down. He'd been cleaning his nets. He didn't want to go through all that again. Jesus said to do it. Peter calls him master, but he doesn't want to do it. What's that mean? It means he doesn't really think he's the master. He's using the word. Doesn't mean it. The next time we find it, chapter 8. In chapter 8, the record is that the disciples had gotten in the boat. Jesus had told them to go to the other side, and they launched out. Jesus was in the boat, and he fell asleep, verse 23. And in verse 24, they came to him saying, Master, Master, we're going to die! And Jesus got up and rebuked the wind and the surging waves, and it became calm. And he said to them, Where is your faith? Now, do you consider that a compliment? Or was that just kind of a, what are you guys doing? You just twice called me master, master, and you're shocked because I am the master. When I tell the wind and the wave to shut up and pipe down, they do it. Well, that's the way masters work. If you're a so-called master and can't do that, well, surely you're not a master. And they call him twice, master, master. And then turn right around and they're just astounded because he is a master, master. So, three times now, well, twice now, master doesn't mean master. It's just a polite word. You know, it's a political thing. Look at chapter 8, verse 45. Jesus is going through this big crowd and everybody's pushing and shoving. There's this woman that's got this hemorrhage. She's unclean and she's pushing her way through the group, and she doesn't want to be known because she knows she's unclean, but she's decided that if she can touch Jesus' garment, she'll be well, and so she's pushing and shoving to get in there, and she reaches out, touches his garment, and her hemorrhage stops, just like she expected. And verse 45, Jesus said, Who is the one who touched me? And Peter says, Master, have you lost your mind? He didn't say it that way. He said this way, Master, the multitudes are crowding and pressing upon you. Is that the way you use the word master? What in the world are you talking about? Don't you see all these people pushing you? You want to know who touched you? Well, just start counting. Master. No, I don't believe that's the way it works. Chapter 9. We are in chapter 9, so we're going to skip verse 33 and go over to verse 49. John answers Jesus after he said, Whoever receives this child in my name receives me. Whoever receives me receives him who sent me. He who is least among you, this is the one who is great. Now listen to that. The one who makes himself humble. The one who makes himself the least among you. He'll be great. Now notice John's response, his answer. Master! We saw somebody casting out demons in your name and we tried to tell him to quit because he doesn't follow us. In other words, Master, we're using your name to exercise our authority as masters. We're bossing these other people around. We're throwing our weight around in the name of Jesus. Right on the heels of Jesus saying, Don't you know that being great in my kingdom means not throwing your weight around? So, did John use the word master legitimately? And then the last time, chapter 17, I want you to look at verse 13 and following. Verse 11 says, It came about, he was on the way to Jerusalem, he was passing between Samaria and Galilee, he entered a certain village, and there were 10 leprous men who stood at a distance who met him, and they raised their voices saying, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. And when he saw them, he said, Go show yourself to the priests. And it came about that as they were going, they were cleansed. This is the master at work. And one of them, when he saw that he'd been healed, turned back, glorifying God with a loud voice, and he fell on his face at Jesus' feet, giving thanks to him. And he was a Samaritan. And Jesus answered and said, Were there not 10 cleansed? Where are the nine? Was no one found who would turn back to give glory to God except this foreigner? Is that how you treat the master? Take the goodies he gives and don't even say thank you. It is my conclusion from looking at the way Luke used the word master in Luke's gospel that he was always putting it on the lips of people who didn't have a clue as to what they were saying. They didn't know. They were using that word to impress somebody, but they didn't mean it. So it's my conclusion that it's clearly within Luke's intention to show that the disciples in general, and Peter in particular, had a very superficial grasp of reality. They didn't have a real good grip on who Jesus was. I mean, they said he was the Christ of the God. But what did that really mean? And when they saw the glory shared with other men, he wanted to build three tabernacles to memorialize all three of them because the light was there. And he called Jesus Master without even understanding what he was saying. And Luke said that. He didn't know what he was saying. Now, why did Luke tell us this? Well, I believe that he was telling us this because he wants us to understand how committed God is to his kingdom program. He is going to get us straightened out. It doesn't matter what it takes. Yeah, we may have our whole concept upside down as far as reality is concerned. We may really think that this is the way it is, but this is the real way it is. It's just completely 180 degrees upside down. And folks, we do. We think all kinds of goofy things. So what's God do? Get really mad and just give up on the plan? No. The reason those guys are up there is because Jesus said their whole world's upside down. They don't have a clue what's going on, so I'm going to make sure that they have a foundation for getting it squared away. And the foundation is going to be their perception of me. So I'm going to show them the kingdom in terms of the king. And that's not going to solve all the problems overnight, but it's going to start solving the problems. And of course, the Father was listening to verse 34, 35, 36. We'll talk about that, Lord willing, next week. But I want you to go away from here this morning understanding two things. We have a lot of progress to make as individuals, as believers. Doesn't matter how long we've been believers. Whether it's been 4 years or 40 years or 4 months or 4 days, it doesn't. The time isn't the issue. We could be here for 1,000 years and we would still have a lot of progress to make in terms of being turned into little Jesus people. We've got a long way to go, all of us. But God's committed to bringing us along. I want you to go home with that in your mind, that He is committed to you and to me, to getting our world turned right side up so that we start valuing what's valuable and believing what's true. And this is a demonstration of it. Peter didn't have a clue, but God didn't. Jesus didn't reject him for his blind ignorance. He addressed it with a solution. Let's pray together. Father, when we see the impact that sin has made in the hearts and minds of people, as it is demonstrated on every page of your word, we have two options. We can take a perspective that destroys us, give up, throw up our hands in defeat, walk away. Or believe that your promises are valid regardless of the reality that we live in. And this morning, Father, I pray that you'll give us the grace to be believing that you're going to take us through whatever it takes to get us thinking straight and believing you and walking with you in the true light of understanding. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.